Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday or Wednesday? It's Tuesday, right? The 14th of July. This hour of the program, turning over control of Iraq to the Iraqis. We're going to be talking about that issue and also looking at the uptick in violence, both in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're happy to have with us Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Donovan with the Wisconsin National Guard, U.S. Army, 32nd Infantry. He is based in Baghdad. And as you know, our officers from Wisconsin are working in Iraq. There are 3,200 members of the 32nd Infantry Brigade Combat Team will continue their duties at seven Iraqi locations where they provide base defense and security. They guard detainees and they are training Iraqi prison guards and performing headquarters and support functions. Lieutenant Colonel Tim Donovan has said that none of our 32nd Brigade units are assigned to missions that would be considered combat forces in cities. Some of our units do have base defense missions, but their responsibilities are well outside cities, and they're focused on the specific bases they're assigned to protect. Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Donovan is with us the first half hour of our program today. Later in the program, Professor Juan Cole will join us. He's a professor of history at the University of Michigan, and he'll be looking at what has happened since U.S. troops have left cities in Iraq and also looking at an increased presence and increased military activity in Afghanistan. We're welcoming phone calls as we always do. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org, for you to join us that way. Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Donovan, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Hi. Thank you for being here. Tell me about
it's a pleasure.
Tell me about your experience in Iraq. When did you get to the country? How long have you been there? And your responsibilities, Lieutenant Colonel?
Well, this all began for us more than a year ago, actually. But we've only been in Iraq about 8 weeks. I think I'm just finishing my eighth week. A couple of units got into Iraq before I did. But most of us have been here for between 8 and 9, maybe a couple of them 10 weeks. So we're really just getting started.
Mm-hmm. And your assigned mission is?
Well, I'm speaking to you from central Baghdad from the International Zone, which is about a 5-square-mile area right in the heart of the capital city. And I'm part of the Joint Area Support Group. We call it the JASG. And our mission is to secure and administer the International Zone, which is the part of the city where the embassies are all located, or most of them are located here. The seat of the Iraq government is in the International Zone, and most of the U.S. forces that are still in Baghdad proper are in the International Zone. Mm-hmm. So we're here to secure and administer the International Zone, and before we're done, to turn most of it over to the government of Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And what are your initial impressions, sir?
My initial impressions are fairly favorable. It's not a place I'd like to live or spend a lot of time. It's very hot here, and it's a very kind of a dusty and dirty place compared to what we have back in Wisconsin. But my overall impressions are of a place that I don't fear for my personal safety.
Mm-hmm.
Very much. Every once in a while you do, but that's fairly rare. And I'm fairly impressed with the progress that's been made here, and especially the past two and a half years. I haven't been here during most of the those months during which the progress has been made. So I'm basing my baseline observation on what I've read, heard back when I was still in Wisconsin. But what I'm seeing now in mid-July in 2009 is a fairly secure, fairly safe, and what appears to be a fairly stable government taking root here.
Mm-hmm. Are you in the process of training? We've heard that there will be a lot of training of Iraqi people who are going to be in charge of detention facilities and also more training of an army there. Is that process in full force right now?
Well, the Wisconsin National Guard troops who are here in Iraq at the moment aren't involved in training the Iraqi army. However, we are absolutely in charge of training the future of the Iraqi Correctional Officer Corps. Several of our units are at a place called Forward Operating Base Future, which is not far from where I am, about 10 miles away near the Baghdad International Airport, where they established, built from the ground up, a National Training Academy for Corrections Officers. So our Wisconsin National Guard troops from communities all over Wisconsin, who are members of these several companies, are going to be building the future of Iraq's Correctional Officer Corps. That's the most obvious training involvement that Wisconsin National Guard forces here have. Most of the rest are involved in working in theater internment facilities. They're called TIFs for short, where they are operating as detainee guard forces and providing base defense for camps Buka, Cropper, Taji, and a few other places in Iraq.
And when does the United States plan to turn over the detention facilities to the Iraqis?
That will probably be sometime after we're gone. I'm not sure. I'm not involved in that directly. I did visit FOB Future about 3-4 weeks ago before they had any classes on the premises. So I really saw this training academy before it was fully up and running. It was still being built by our Wisconsin National Guard forces at that time. But I don't know the specific timeline.
Mm-hmm. And what about the specific ideas of the rules of engagement there? Obviously, we've been in a bit of trouble over that issue. Are there very strict guidelines as to how detainees will be treated?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I can assure you and anybody else in Wisconsin that Wisconsin National Guard soldiers, the men and women who bring our values from Wisconsin here to Iraq, are treating these detainees with dignity and respect. And they're doing that for a number of good reasons. First, it's the right thing to do. Secondly, it reflects our values as a nation and as an army and as a National Guard. And third, because many of these detainees will be released back into Iraq, and they'll remember that they were treated humanely and treated with respect by U.S. Army soldiers who happen to be soldiers from the Wisconsin National Guard. Dignity and respect you hear a lot when you're operating or visiting the theater internment facilities, the TIFs where the detainees are held.
Mm-hmm. We have heard news reports here of an uptick in violence in the last couple of weeks since U.S. troops pulled out of cities in Iraq, some really bad bomb attacks in the country. Can you tell me about the uptick in violence that's going on? Is it noticeable in Iraq right now? And is there any way that the Wisconsin National Guard can help in that regard?
Well, it's noticeable here where I am in that we hear the explosions once in a while. When we first got to the international zone, we were located in a little bit different area. We were about a mile east of where we are now. And for the first 2 or 3 weeks, we had some rocket and or mortar attacks on the area of the international zone where we were. And they were fairly frequent for about 3 weeks. Then we moved. It had nothing to do with these attacks. It was a planned move. We just had to wait for spaces to be finished for us. And we moved about a mile west. And I'm not aware of any attacks since then. But every once in a while, you do hear an explosion over the T-walls that separate us from the so-called red zone of Baghdad. And, of course, there have been attacks in Sadr City, up in some areas of northern Iraq, but a lot of them had been concentrated here in the Baghdad area.
Mm-hmm.
Not so many anymore. They seem to be staging these attacks to get noticed at about the time the transition of security from U.S. forces in the cities to Iraqi security forces was taking place. And as you know, that deadline was June 30th, and it. The deadline came and it went pretty successfully.
Mm-hmm. My understanding is that you could be called in to help should things get more out of control. Is that right?
Well, anybody who's a soldier or a sailor or an airman or a Marine can be called in to do whatever needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
But no, we're not expecting the kind of unit I'm in, and with the responsibilities we have, we're not expecting that. U.S. forces will always have the authority to defend themselves. So if U.S. forces are attacked and need to defend themselves, they do not have to wait for Iraqi security. They can defend themselves, and that's allowed under the provisions of the U.S.-Iraq security agreement that took effect January 1st and continues in effect.
You have said, Lieutenant Colonel Donovan, that you're watching this milestone, this withdrawal of U.S. troops from cities with great interest, and we're hoping the Iraqi security forces are successful as they take over increasing levels of responsibility. Can you tell me your idea of where they are right now? Are they on the way to success? Are they rapidly becoming successful? Is it a long haul?
Well, at the very least, they're on the way to being successful. Actually 2 weeks ago today, was June 30th when my security, the security of Tim Donovan and the people that Tim Donovan works with here in the international zone, is now the primary responsibility of Iraqi security forces. So our safety is in their hands. So that's one of the reasons we're hoping that they're successful.
Yeah, I would imagine.
And so far, so good.
How are they keeping you safe, sir?
Well, they're keeping the bad guys out of the places that bad guys aren't allowed, and that's the center of Baghdad where we are in the international zone.
Uh-huh. You said that you felt some measure of nervousness. I'd be really nervous if I were there. And I would imagine that it's rather unnerving to hear explosions going on around you. How do you deal with a constant danger in a country?
Well, first you have to understand that there's nothing you can do about some things. If a rocket or a mortar has your name on it, you're not going to have a very good day. So there are some things you just can't worry about. It doesn't pay to worry about something you can't affect. But if you do get a warning that that you're under attack, there are things that you do, and we do those things to keep ourselves as safe as possible. But you just can't worry about some of these things. You'd go crazy worrying about them, and there's nothing you can do. So you just keep working.
And with that kind of philosophy, you'll probably live longer, don't you think?
Well, I hope that's my plan. I hope so, too.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. Our guest this half hour, first half hour, is Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Donovan, joining us by phone today from Baghdad. He's with the Wisconsin National Guard, U.S. Army 32nd Infantry, and they are at work training corrections officers. As you know, the National Guard is performing a vital service in that regard, as this milestone took place 2 weeks ago today with U.S. withdrawal from cities in Iraq and transfer, which will take some time, but turning over control of the country to the Iraqis and training security forces and people who will be running detention facilities being trained by the Wisconsin National Guard. Our phone number, join us. We only have a few more minutes with Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Donovan. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And you can also send an email. We have time for you to do that. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Please feel free to join our conversation a few more minutes with Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Donovan, and then Professor Juan Cole will be joining us, professor of history at the University of Michigan, as we talk about what's going on in Iraq and also We'll be looking at Afghanistan as well with Professor Cole. Our number, join us. You're quiet today. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. A reminder, the second hour of our program today, we've been doing a series of programs on healthcare, looking at other countries. Last week, we started with an examination of the Canadian healthcare system. Today, we will look at the reform proposals that are being discussed in the United States. Bill Potasnik will join us, CEO of Frederick Hospital here in Milwaukee. So stay tuned for that important conversation. Next week, we'll be looking at France, and we'll look at Caribbean nations the following week. So all of that is coming up. 800-486-8655 is our number. Tell me about the zone, a little bit more about the zone that you're in, the international zone, Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Donovan. Do you feel cut off pretty much from the rest of Baghdad? Can you describe it for me?
Well, we travel pretty freely within the international zone. It's about 3 miles from east to west and a couple of miles from north to south at its widest, and then it gets actually kind of narrow where we are. It's right along the banks of the Tigris River. We're very near the U.S. Embassy complex, some other national embassies. Australians and the U.K. are here in the international zone. The Al-Rashid Hotel, which became fairly famous during the first Gulf War in 1991, is at one edge of the international zone, and we travel up that way once in a while. It's the heart of the city, but we do feel a little bit cut out of the rest of the city. We occasionally get a chance to leave the international zone to go out and do some work and travel to the places where we need to go. But most of our world is this five-square-mile area right in the heart of the city.
Mm-hmm. You've talked about all the efforts that have been made so far cannot be successful in the end unless Iraqis are capable of providing for their own security. Tell me about the day-to-day kind of training that's going on that will allow the Iraqis to be capable of providing for their own security.
I'm not seeing the training. I'm not sure what kind of a training program Iraqi security forces are taking part in. The Iraqi security forces that I see at the entry control points, the checkpoints that determine who can come in to the international zone seem to be run by Iraqi security forces that know their job quite well. They seem to me to be well-disciplined, well-equipped, professional security force. But I don't know how they got there. Their training occurred many months or maybe many years before I got here.
Mm-hmm. And how long will you be there? Do you know?
Well, we expect we'll be home probably toward the end of January in 2010. So we're a couple of months in and have about six months left. Mm-hmm. Before we are ready to head home. But we're not focusing on home yet. There's lots of work to do here, and we're going to keep concentrating on it, keep our head in the game, and we'll worry about coming home when that time gets a little closer.
Mm-hmm. And the plan is for most forces to be gone by August of 2010?
Most, but not all. And I believe the president has determined, subject to the environment here, that all U.S. forces might be out by 2011. It's important for people to know that we're here at the invitation of the government of Iraq. People are calling this a war and are calling it an occupation, but the government of Iraq is a sovereign nation. Iraq is a sovereign nation with a government in charge, and this government has invited U.S. and other coalition forces to assist in creating a stable environment so that this government can continue to take root and grow into a success.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell me about the nature of the detainees? Are there a number of people being detained right now, and why they might be detained and how eventually they win their freedom again?
Well, some of them are terrorists. Some of them are common criminals. Some of them are suspected to be terrorists or suspected to be common criminals waiting to work their way through the Iraqi justice system, and they'll be released when the Iraqi government, not us, when the government of Iraq determines that they no longer pose a threat to this society and have paid for whatever crimes brought them into a detention facility.
Mm-hmm.
This is all being done by the government of Iraq, not by the United States.
Mm-hmm. But they must keep you informed about because you're involved in...
Well, they don't keep me informed,
right.
But I don't work in the detention business. But our troops are merely there to keep these detention facilities secured, to keep the bad guys in, and to keep other bad guys from interfering with their operations. So we're both guarding the detainees and securing the perimeters of the detainee facilities camps, and they do that without really getting involved at all in any of the determinations about who comes, who goes, who gets released. Those decisions are all made by the government of Iraq.
So the transfer process indeed is underway.
Well, many detainees have been released. I believe there are detainees being released on a regular basis. Camp Buka, one of the camps with large detention facilities in the far south of Iraq near the Persian Gulf and a community called Umm Qasr, is in the process of closing. And many of our National Guard forces from Wisconsin are at this particular facility called Camp Buka. And as its detainee population is reduced, our forces are sent elsewhere where they're needed. And eventually, I don't think there will be any detention guard force troops involved at all. But that's some months away. I'm not sure that will happen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure when that will happen.
And tell me, from what you hear and from what you've seen, what's your assessment of how well the infrastructure is operating? We hear stories that the electricity is sporadic, that it's getting better, but it's still pretty hard to live in Iraq. Would you agree with that?
Well, it's a little sporadic even where we are.
Is it?
Our facilities aren't on the grid. Most of our, I think all of our electric power is generated here on the forward operating bases where we live and work for us, but it goes on and off a little bit. Of course, generators need to be maintained, and they need oil changed and fluid checked, fluid levels checked. So a couple of times a week for periods of an hour or two, we lose electric power here. I believe it's the same, maybe not even quite that good in other parts of Baghdad, but it's a bit of a problem. The plumbing systems aren't up to the standards of certainly Wisconsin. For the people of Iraq, for the people of Baghdad, and for we National Guard soldiers from Wisconsin who are living here, it's just not what we're used to. Everything's a little less developed than back home.
Right, I'm sure. And I'm sure you miss home, too, don't you?
We do.
Mm-hmm. Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Donovan, thank you very much for being with us. You're coming in loud and clear from Baghdad.
All right. My pleasure.
Lieutenant Colonel Timothy Donovan with the Wisconsin National Guard, U.S. Army, the 32nd Infantry, and talking to us by phone from Baghdad to talk about the work of the 32nd Infantry Brigade Combat Team. They're providing base defense and security, training Iraqi prison guards, performing headquarters and support functions. And we thank him for being with us. Going to broaden our conversation just a bit now, Professor Juan Cole joining us the next half hour of the program, professor of history at the University of Michigan, will be looking at an uptick in violence in Iraq, and we'll also talk about what the mission is in Afghanistan, the increased U.S. military presence in Afghanistan, and what the end goal is in that country with Professor Cole. And welcoming your phone calls, you are incredibly silent today, so feel free to join us. Fairly important issue we're discussing. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, as always, is talk at WPR.org, talk at WPR.org. Professor Juan Cole was quoted recently as saying that the massive ethnic and sectarian cleansing in Iraq under the nose of the U.S. military forces bodes ill for Iraq. He was a critic of the war, and he will be talking more about what he means by that, the ethnic and sectarian cleansing, and also what the goals are in Afghanistan as we beef up our presence in that country and there is more violence in Afghanistan. We'll be talking with Professor Cole about all of that and welcoming your calls when they come in about what your thoughts are concerning our involvement in both Iraq and Afghanistan. The second hour of our program today, we continue our series, 10 o'clock on Tuesdays, on health care reform. We've been looking at We looked at Canada for one of the countries, and we'll be looking next week at France. Today, it will be the healthcare reform proposals that are on the table here in the United States. Can everybody agree on something, or is there a likelihood that we're not going to see any kind of substantial reform because history is repeating itself and we never seem to be able to move forward on that important issue? Bill Ptasnik will join us. He is the CEO of Friedert Hospital here in Milwaukee. So that's coming up. With us now is Professor Juan Cole. Professor Juan Cole, been a long time since we spoke with you. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Kathleen.
Yeah. Well, you have warned recently about the massive ethnic and sectarian cleansing in Iraq under the nose of U.S. military forces bodes ill for Iraq. Tell me about that cleansing that's been taking place and what worries you.
Well, it's a kind of story that has been told in the press to some extent, but I think people don't keep it in their minds. The big ethnic cleansing occurred in Baghdad. I figure when the U.S. conquered Iraq in 2003, Baghdad, the capital, a city of some 6 million, was roughly 50-50 Sunni and Shiite. Might have been a slight preponderance of Shiites. But now, given the results of the provincial elections in Baghdad in January, and what else we know, my suspicion is it's down to 10-15% max Sunni.
Really? Oh, my.
Yeah, it's a huge change in the complexion of the city. And it was a result of Shiite militias responding to guerrilla attacks by Sunni Arab guerrilla groups on civilians in Shiite neighborhoods. And I think they decided that if this kind of thing was going to go on, better not to have any Sunnis at all around to give them a safe harbor. And so they threatened people. I was doing research in Jordan last summer. With the refugees, but a lot of them had been personally threatened. If you know, so-and-so shows his face again in this neighborhood, he's a dead man. Then about a quarter of the families who have applied for refugee aid in Jordan among the Iraqis have had a child kidnapped.
Oh, my goodness.
So that was another technique to get rid of them. Multi-purpose, the Shiite militia would kidnap a Sunni child, get the ransom, and then when the child was returned, they'd threaten them, and then they'd run away to Jordan or Syria. I mean, we think there's over 1 million Iraqis in Syria and a couple hundred thousand in Jordan. And then, of course, some have gone on to the West, or 40,000 in Sweden. So the geographers at UCLA looked at the ambient light coming off of Baghdad to satellite photos, and they found that West Baghdad, which was largely Sunni, went dark sort of late 2006 and has never recovered. So there just aren't very many people living there. To the extent that they are, the Shiite militias have moved into other people's homes.
So does that bode, well, obviously it doesn't bode well for some kind of unified government here, but what's to happen to they have people feel safe enough to come back and to have people included in governing their country?
They don't feel safe enough to come back. I was asking them, you know, why don't you go back? Because the violence is down from what it was. And they said nothing to go back to.
They've lost their property. The nature of their neighborhood has changed. Some of them are mixed families. You know, they wouldn't feel comfortable, the spouse is Shiite or the spouse is Sunni, being in a neighborhood of the other sort. And the number of mixed neighborhoods has declined radically. And then they're traumatized. They've seen friends or family gunned down, or they've had a child kidnapped, as I said. They've been personally threatened. Even some of the ones living abroad are tracked down by the militias and threatened again, which is pretty chilling. So they're not going back right now anyway. And if they ever do decide to come back, there are going to be huge legal and social problems about that. I mean, you're talking about at least several hundred thousand people and maybe over a million.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't sound like they're going to come back anytime soon. And what does that mean for what the country is, what Iraq is? What is it now?
Right. Well, it just underlines that it's a Shiite government.
Mm-hmm.
And it now has a demographic base, a popular base in the capital. But it's a base that's been won by this horrible process of expelling people and killing them. I mean, at the height of the ethnic cleansing in 2006 and 2007, you had 2,000 and 3,000 civilians killed a month in the most horrible ways. And so that's one big problem. There are some others, and including in the northern part of Iraq, you have significant conflict between three ethnic groups, Kurds, Sunnis, and Turkmen.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been instances of cities changing their content, changing who lives there in a big way in the north as well. So, for instance, the city of Talafer in the north is a largely Turkmen city. The Turkmen speak a language akin to Turkish, that's a neighboring country. And there are probably 800,000 or so in northern Iraq. They claim to be 4 million, but it's not plausible. But Talafer is a largely Turkmen city, and the Turkmen are evenly divided between Sunni and Shiite. And it had a big Sunni population, but some of them went over to the what the Americans call Al-Qaeda, or the Sunni extremists, and the Kurdish police and the Turkmen of a Shiite background cooperated with the Americans in attacking those Sunni guerrillas, and in the process there were airstrikes, and the Sunni Turkmen, a lot of them had to leave the city, and so it is now predominantly Turkmen Shiite.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Kirkuk, the northern oil province, is also changing. Kurds are coming in. Some of them were families that had been expelled by Saddam Hussein, who did ethnic cleansing deliberately and kind of Arabized the northern provinces by bringing in Arabs from the south. But now the Kurds are coming back. But, you know, beyond the ones that are returning home, there are new Kurds coming in and being encouraged to do so behind the scenes by the Kurdistan government. And they are hoping to establish a Kurdish majority so that they can then have a referendum on Kirkuk's future. And the Kurds hope that Kirkuk will be joined to the semi-autonomous region of Kurdistan, which consists of three northern provinces that have now been erased as provinces and have just become a Kurdistan confederacy.
Hmm. So it's moving closer and closer, except that there's not much as much Sunni presence to becoming a partition place, you think? It'll only be partition between the Kurds and the Shiites?
Well, the issue in Kirkuk is ethnic, so it's between Kurds on the one hand and Arabs, both Sunni and Shiite, but largely Sunni, on the other, and then Turkmen. And the Arabs and the Turkmen don't want to become an even tinier minority in Kirkuk, in Kurdistan. They don't want Kirkuk to be annexed to Kurdistan. And so there's been significant violence in Kirkuk, the city, as well as in its hinterland, between Kurds and Arabs and Turkmen. This could, you know, this could go to pretty significant violence if it's not resolved diplomatically. And it's very dangerous because, you know, one of the things I worry about is if there were ever a big fight between Kurds and Turkmen, the Kurds are much more numerous and would win. If Turkmen got massacred in the course of that fight, the country of Turkey would be under enormous popular pressure to intervene.
Oh.
I mean, you'd have hundreds of thousands of people demonstrating in Ankara on behalf of the Turkmen. And you can already see, you know, in Western China, the recent riots have produced some Turkmen, some Uyghur dead.
Mm-hmm.
And the Turkish government denounced that as a genocide and deeply criticized China. So you can imagine if this kind of thing were going on right next door between Kurds and Turkmen, Turkey would feel impelled to get involved.
Let's welcome phone calls for you. Our guest, Professor Juan Cole. He is professor of history at the University of Michigan, has written extensively and spent quite a bit of time in the Middle East, and we're welcoming phone calls for him. We'll start in a moment. Did I give you – I forget about this number all the time. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we'll talk about all that's on the table in terms of healthcare reform proposals here in the United States. Bill Ptasnik, president and CEO of Friedert Hospital here in Milwaukee, will be our guest. All right, let's go to phone calls for Professor Juan Cole. Kasser is our first caller from Germantown. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I am a Shia Muslim from Pakistan. And I'm listening to your conversation about the situation in Baghdad. In order to understand what's going on now, you have to go back a long time, almost 1,400 years, and there's a history to it. Muhammad, the difference between Shia and Muslims is very minor. The only thing is that Shias believe more in Muhammad's family, and Muhammad's family from 6 months old to as old as 70-year-old men were killed and prosecuted and killed by the Sunnis. So this animosity goes a long way back. And in Iraq, you pick a rock and there's a Shia shrine. So obviously, all Shias are going to come and gather in their country. There are one or two Shia shrines in Iran, which is 97% Shia. Whereas Iraq, this the whole of the thing that differentiated between Shias and Sunnis took place in a place called Karbala in Iraq. And the other thing is, you have to understand, 20% of Sunnis control the whole country. And, you know, obviously when the tyrant has left, the Shias have room now. They want to come back and they want to be close to the shrines. And the second part about Quds is, this is the only homeless nation besides Palestinians in the world, which if there was a country of Quds, it will be the largest Middle Eastern country. So unfortunately, our foreign policy is very tainted, and it always takes the side of the tyrants. And we should allow these Quds to have a separate country because they deserve a separate country, and we should allow the Shias to come back and prosper in the land that they want to be in. If we can allow Jews to come back to Israel, why can't we allow Shias to come back to Iraq and be where their loved shrines or the people that we love are buried there?
Professor Cole.
Well, the caller makes a lot of good points, and I thank him for reminding us of the history. By the way, I have a recent book out, Engaging the Muslim World, in which I try to give some of this background for Iraq. One of the things I would caution listeners about, however, is that you can't assume that just because people are Sunni and Shiite that they're necessarily antagonistic to one another. on that basis. And actually, if you go back in 20th century Iraq, there was very little Sunni Shiite violence, almost never, in fact, on that basis. The 1990s were, in some ways, the beginning of large-scale conflict after the Gulf War. But even then, it was on a party basis. You know, it was a Shiite clandestine party based in Iran versus the Ba'ath Party. And the Ba'ath Party had a lot of Shiites in it, so it wasn't exactly ethnic. But the ethnic violence really developed after 2003 when there was a vacuum at the center. The government had fallen. People were reorganizing themselves. And, you know, political entrepreneurs, some of them decided to play the sectarian card. But that's not inevitable. And what we've learned from the Balkans and elsewhere is that people can learn to hate really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a tendency, I think, for us to think, well, that if they hate each other so much and they're killing each other and ethnically cleansing each other, that this must be an ages-old thing. But actually, often, no. I mean, there wasn't a long history of violence between Bosnians and Serbs, for instance, in the Balkans in the 20th century. And likewise, Sunnis and Shiites have had their differences, but there was a lot of intermarriage, and they were in the same parties and so forth. So this thing that happened in the past 7 years is new and unprecedented, and so is the scale of the civil violence and the suicide bombings. You know, you didn't have suicide bombings in Iraq until after the conquest by the Americans.
Mm-hmm. It always amazes me, though, Professor Cole, how memories stretch back 1,400 years or 1,000 years. It happens in places all over the world that people remember this, and it makes it extremely difficult, I would think, to forget your old grievances, and they may be quite valid, but to move forward.
Well, what I'm trying to say is that I don't think that the problem is age-old grievances, and indeed people got along perfectly well in the 60s and 70s, despite having the same religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the problem is when there's a vacuum of power, then people try to fill it in various ways, and there are some politicians who appeal to the worst in people, and I think that's what's happened in Iraq often. But, you know, there are grievances between Protestants and Catholics in the West, but you can see in the United States where there's a separation of religion and state, and you can't mobilize people so easily on a religious basis for political power, those differences don't typically erupt into violence or massive ethnic cleansing and so forth. In Northern Ireland, where in the UK, there's not so much of a separation of religion and state, and religion can be pertinent to political power, then there's a struggle. So I think it really is not a matter of how people remember the past so much as what they're aiming for with regard to their political future and whether things are set up so that mobilizing religious hatreds can sometimes get somebody something.
Right. Thanks, Kasser, for your call. We have lines open. We were having problems with our phones, which is, and so now you can get through, 800-486-8655. Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
Hi.
Another fine guest. And may I ask Professor Cole two, I think, related questions, and they're probably both naive. The first is, is a confederal system still possible and on the cards for Iraq, where the central government would be dispensing oil revenues? And perhaps would that exacerbate the problem with the Kurds and what is an emergent Kurdistan? And then second, are the surrounding states that have their own population, parts of associated populations in Iraq, do they want to defuse the situation? Iran surely doesn't want Shia problems in Iraq, which would rebound on it, for instance. So Is there a hope that the neighbors want to stabilize Iraq rather than participate in destabilization? And finally, does the continued presence of the United States act to stabilize or destabilize the situation? So thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
Well, Iraq is a confederal system and has been compared by some to Canada in this regard, in the sense that, you know, Quebec has certain provincial prerogatives that are not shared by English-speaking provinces. And so, in the same way, Kurdistan has prerogatives that other provincial units don't have in Iraq. And that's likely to continue. There's nobody's really talking about taking away prerogatives from Kurdistan that they now enjoy. What's at issue, in my view, is whether Kurdistan expands. And so, you know, does Kirkuk get added to it? And the Kurds are nationalists, sub-nationalists in their own right, and they would like to add parts of other provinces, Diyala and Nineveh, to Kurdistan, and maybe the entirety of them. They have their Kurdish paramilitary, the Peshmerga, which is kind of their national guard, is stationed, you know, beyond the borders of Kurdistan into Iraq proper, some 200 miles often. And so there's increasing conflict between the central government in Baghdad, which doesn't dispute Kurdistan and its borders and its prerogatives, but wants to roll back the assertion of Kurdish power beyond Kurdistan into Iraq proper. And there actually were firefights between the central government's army and the Peshmerga on the Kurdish side in Diyala province late summer. So this is an ongoing problem. But I think, yeah, Iraq will be confederal in that sense. The idea that then-Senator Joe Biden had, now Vice President Biden, that Iraq might be divided, kind of soft partition into three big provinces, Shiite, Sunni, and Kurdish, I think is going nowhere. And the Iraqis themselves mostly did not want that. In fact, poor Biden was denounced roundly by the Iraqi parliament. With regard to the Americans, I think their presence is a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, of course, they do keep some order, and there would be violence in some instances if they weren't there to stop it. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I think they make the Kurds and the Shiites, who are their main allies, less willing to compromise with Sunnis. I mean, ordinarily in politics, if you had a group that was deeply dissatisfied, it was producing terrorism and social violence, the government would of course try to repress that, but it might at the same time go to them and say, "Well, see here, you know, what could we do to satisfy you and stop this?" But in Iraq, with American military presence, they can just go to the American military and say, "Those people are giving us trouble. Would you please bomb them?" Hmm. So I think it makes them more rigid and less willing to compromise. And my suspicion is that as the U.S. withdraws, the Shiite government will find it necessary to accommodate some Sunni demands in a way that now it's not willing to.
We only have about a minute and a half left, so give me something on Afghanistan. we got a mission.
Well, it's going the other way, right? We've got a We've got a drawdown in Iraq and a buildup in Afghanistan. I think the buildup is largely for the purpose of conducting the August elections, presidential elections, which, however, the incumbent, Hamid Karzai, is likely to win. A lot of people think Karzai is one of the big problems in Afghanistan. He only controls about 30% of the country, and he's bringing back the warlords to help him. But a lot of them have big blood on their hands. So, you asked, is there a mission? I really have to tell you that beyond holding the election, I can't entirely understand what they think, some nearly 100,000 American and NATO troops are going to be doing in that country. I don't think that the Pashtun people of the South, who some of whom are dissatisfied and who are engaging in guerrilla violence, and that's been think that they're going to deal well with a bigger foreign troop presence. And the Soviets had 150,000 troops in Afghanistan and weren't able to prevail. So, Afghanistan is tricky, and I have to say that I couldn't tell you exactly what they think their mission is, and I think President Obama is ordering various reviews because he may be, according to the press, a little frustrated himself in knowing what the military thinks its mission is.
Mm-hmm. Professor Juan Cole, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Kathleen.
Professor Juan Cole, Richard P. Mitchell Collegiate Professor of History at the University of Michigan, who has written extensively about the Middle East, spent a lot of time in the Mideast, and his latest book is Engaging the Muslim World. We thank him for his time. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. News is coming up in just a moment from National Public Radio, and then we'll be returning with another in our series of programs on healthcare reform, a major issue in this country, and certainly one that the president has deemed to be extremely important. We've been looking at healthcare systems in various parts of the world, and today it'll be here in the U.S. So stay with us. Join the conversation. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.